Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is the award-winning pioneer of queer cinema, Barbara Hammer. Hammer began making films in the early 1970s and is known for creating groundbreaking experimental films dealing with women's issues, gender issues, lesbian relationships, and coping with aging and illness. Hammer created some of the first lesbian films in history with the release of her 1974 film, Dyke Tactics, and the 1976 film, Women I Love. In the past 40 years, in addition to film, she has worked with experimental video art, digital photography, and performance installation works. She has had many major retrospectives, including at the Tate Modern in London and MoMA in New York City. In April this year, she was awarded the prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship. And I'm talking to Barbara Hammer by phone from her office in New York City. Barbara Hammer, thank you so much for joining us. I want to talk to you about this legend that around the age of 30, you got out of an unhappy marriage, hopped on a motorcycle, and with an 8mm camera began making films. I mean, is this really how your career began?
Oh, my God, it sounds so dramatic when I hear it from someone else. Oh, you know, there's slides into that. For instance, I was shooting film, Super 8 and 8mm, when I was married, about a year or two before I divorced. And, yes, then I did hop on a motorcycle and continued shooting and found my way into the lesbian community of San Francisco.
Uh-huh. And, you know, I understand that you actually started your creative work as a painter.
Yes, I had decided that I wanted to be in the arts. I have two MAs. The first one was in English literature. And then I decided that I wanted to be an artist, so I took many, many classes. And the one that drew me the most before I met film was painting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I studied with William Morehouse, who started the graduate program in painting at the San Francisco Art Institute. And he told me how hard it was to be an artist and tried to discourage me. But it was shortly after that that he suggested that I was more interested in movement than I was in applying paint to canvas. And he brought in an old projector so that I could paint on film and then project that onto a canvas.
Wow.
So that's how I started.
Wow, that's fascinating. Now you actually came out around the same time that you hopped on that motorcycle. And I understand that you started coming out when you went to a consciousness-raising group. I remember those.
Yes, I actually did go to consciousness-raising groups. But, you know, my motorcycle activity goes back to when I was 21 and got married and told Clayton Henry Ward that I would marry him if he would go around the world with me on a motorcycle.
Really?
Yeah. So 3 years later, time was up. We hadn't done anything. So lo and behold, we hitchhiked up to Canada, went over to Milan, Italy, and picked up a motor scooter, and we drove it around the world.
Wow.
It's taking 1 year, camping out, cooking most of the time, on a little camp stove, you know, in Iran, in Iraq. You know, going down the Euphrates Valley before the dates were destroyed, that whole date section in southern Iraq.
Uh-huh.
It was a fabulous field trip.
Oh, I'll bet. It must have opened up your eyes as a creative person in ways that you can't even describe.
Well, I knew I wanted to travel the rest of my life and know the globe. I found every culture fascinating. I would learn a little bit of language, you know, enough to shop and to talk about what I needed. And, yeah, in Iran I got chased because I was wearing culottes and went too, they looked like a short skirt or shorts, and I went too close to a holy stone. And, you know, I mean, there were some tight moments on the trip.
I'll bet. I'll bet. Yeah. Well, I want to talk about the fact that you began making films that had never been attempted before about women's lives, lesbian lives. Well, what made you start down that road? Did you receive a lot of opposition?
Well, I didn't receive any opposition because I was working as an artist for myself. But the reason why I started making lesbian films was because after I left my husband, I came out and I touched a woman and made love with her. And I found that touching a woman's body was similar to touching my own because she had the same shape and the same kind of smoothness, texture of skin. And that increased my sense of touch.
Mm-hmm.
And then my first second film, 16-millimeter film, was Dyke Tactics. And that film explores lesbian sexuality and eroticism, both in the country and in the privacy of a home. And there are 110 images in the film in 4 minutes, and every image has a sense of touch in it. And this became my lesbian aesthetic, although I made the film before I identified what I was doing. And I think that happens with visual artists. Many times we just go with our intuition and our impulse, and we make work, and then later we put words to it.
Yeah. Now, was it difficult to get women to come before the camera and show themselves in those intimate, erotic ways?
Well, no, because this was the 70s. This was a wonderful time that hasn't been repeated. I mean, we had the late 60s with the hippie movement. Women were already dressing, half-dressing, going topless in Golden Gate Park with Allen Ginsberg reading, and there was that freedom of sexual expression movement. We were reading Open Marriage, those of us who were married. So to transition from there into the early 70s with the lesbian movement, we were breaking all kinds of taboos, and we thought we had a right to do what we wanted, and we thought we were changing the world, and we were, but it's just taken much longer than we thought.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So nobody that at least I hung out with had any inhibitions about being nude and in front of the camera. And there was also a great interest in women's sexuality. There was a place where my friends, T. Corinne, and others were getting their PhD in human sexuality. It was called the Human Sexuality Institute in San Francisco. And they were understanding the physiology of the sexual response cycle, and they were showing me and telling me about it, and that's why we were filming ourselves having orgasms. And, you know, this was part of the tenor of my body, myself, you know, take back who you are and own it, and and be free of religious institutional constrictions about whether you should wear clothes or not. So it was really films that could not have been made in the 80s.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or the 90s.
I know. Isn't that amazing to think that the progress that you made has sort of been dissipated by a different era?
Yeah, dissipated, but on the other hand, look at DOMA being defeated. Thesis for those of us who are involved with people from overseas. I mean, there's for immigration rights, for gays and lesbians, transgendered, there's just so much change.
There is, absolutely.
You know, we have to think that, I mean, the whole country, you know, changing enough to strike down DOMA, you know, and support the Supreme Court in that decision, that's pretty big,
you know,
if you want to look at Russia.
Absolutely, it really did. It felt like a miracle.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the trilogy on Dyke's and Dyke history that you made. The first one was called Nitrate Kisses. Now, the beginning of that film, you have biographical material about Willa Cather. Was she your symbol of hidden and closeted lives, and do you think things have changed that much?
Well, yes. Especially, I'm glad we are talking about Willa Cather. The film starts there because Willa Cather burned all her love letters. So she was hiding herself as well as her archive. And when I went to the archive, it still wasn't possible to say, you know, in Red Cloud, Nebraska, I'm looking for, you know, lesbian links to this literary figure. And so instead, you know, I would look for all the details I could find in her life and all the photographs I could find. I find her cross-dressing in high school and wearing her hair really butch much, much earlier than that, probably elementary school, you know. So you do your own sleuthing. And she was the symbol that I used. You could have used many other women or men or transgendered people for that situation, just to open the film, but the film is about history. It's not about particular people, and it's about how history is made, and who's left out of history, and who makes history, and what are we going to give to our children in the future so that they're going to know about our lives. Mm-hmm. So she was a good example in why it has changed today. Well, Sharon O'Brien had written a biography on Catherine. I went to hear her read. This was back, I think the film came out in 90, finished in December 92. So it may have been sometime in 92 I heard her read in New York, and I said, why didn't you include the fact that she was a lesbian? And she said, well, I couldn't, you know, find really first person or authoritative experts who would say that she was.
Mm-hmm.
But now there's been a whole new trove just in the New York Times this summer. A new trove of her letters have been found.
I read about that, yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So now we have first person identification of herself.
Uh-huh.
So that's why it's very important for all of us to save our own archives and keep a track so that people don't have to go through the difficulties of guesswork and supposition that we do to find our foremothers. Because I think we can't have a lesbian culture without a foundation to stand on, and the foundation are the women who've come before us.
Mm-hmm. Are you surprised that so many people still have a hard time coming out? I mean, it's still a big deal when somebody comes out, a famous actor or actress or somebody on TV.
Well, I am not surprised if for a public figure. I am surprised for a non-public figure. Those of us who maybe are just beginning our career or are mid-career and we find an acceptance in the workforce, so we do come out without any kind of horns or whistles. But if somebody is a star, who knows who would hire them next, if that person might be homophobic or not. So I think they're taking a bigger risk because fame is like a job.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They have to keep it going, feed the fires with, you know, their romantic appeal or whatever. I personally don't like celebrity culture at all.
And I
don't follow it, and I don't know who many people are and the references to the films they're in or the television that they're in. I see myself more as an artist who works in film and other media.
Yeah, I can understand that. So do you have anything to say about the fact that there's still so much talk about how few women are becoming directors and filmmakers? How do you feel about that?
I think it's disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have a great talent. The way we have been socialized to be able to relate to other people is so important in directing. And since the feminist movement, the way, and with precursors who had no problem with identity formation before the feminist movement, the sense of claiming our own identity, our own strength, our agency, that is happening today and among young women I see, and with old women like myself who just grow stronger in that regard, we make perfect directors.
Mm-hmm.
And why is it so hard? Because sexism still exists, not just in the film industry, but across the board.
Absolutely.
In almost all different disciplines, choices of employment, it's not a fight that's been won yet.
Right. If you're just joining us, my guest is Barbara Hammer. She's an award-winning pioneer of queer cinema. And you know what I want to talk to you about, too? That the third film of your lesbian history trilogy is called History Lessons. And I find that fascinating. You talk about lesbians portrayed by men in this film.
You know, when I was thinking, if Lilla Cather's hiding our history, where are the lesbian movies that were made before Stonewall? Where are the images? I can't find them, perhaps, in, you know, common literary culture, and I don't really want to repeat those that we already know. So, going from my idea that I already said that we can't have a culture unless we have a foundation, I thought, let's go back to the negative images that were made of lesbians before Stonewall, the medicalization of lesbians, the legalization of lesbians, the biological determinism of lesbians.
And the tragedy.
Maybe a larger than straight women.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the films were tragic, too, right? Remember The Foxes, that D.H. Lawrence film?
Yeah. And the tragedies, and take those films and make a comedy out of them. That's a way of recapturing our history and turning it, ironically, into something that we can use. So we, you know, there it is right before you, how these women were set up for pornographic scenes. And yet, if you turn it into a comedy, it can be read today by lesbians, and they are empowered by it because a lesbian did that. A lesbian director made the film. It's a way, it's kind of an unusual way to claim history.
Oh, I think it's great.
I mean, it's very unusual. But I found that that was the excitement and the challenge in making that film.
Are some of these films still being shown at festivals so that women can go back and see
Bogota.
The history of the history, sort of women in film?
Yeah, they're being shown in universities, in film classes, and I've had four retrospectives in the last 2 years. Both of those films were shown in London at the Tate, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Toronto International Film Festival in Canada, and Jeu de Paume Museum of Photography in Paris. And in, you know, all of a complete oeuvre, so to speak, was shown in all those. And now I'm going to Bogota, Colombia, next month for a small retrospective of my work. I think they're showing maybe five programs of an hour each or more. And I'll be there in person, and then I'm going on to Brazil to work on a new project.
Is it still kind of unique and exciting for lesbians in the 21st century to see films like these? Because our lives are not really seen everywhere still.
That's right. I mean, you know, you have to, I guess it's contextual. What country are you in? Because we are so global now in the digital age. We have YouTube and Vimeo, and we can see lesbian images on those. You can listen to lectures at the European Graduate School where I teach and hear me talk about lesbian film. I mean, we are available if you have the money and the class, the two going together, if you have the money or the opportunity to use the Internet. I don't know if they're, I think they're still viable. In fact, the films from the 70s are having there's a resurgence of interest in them by young queer scholars, because they find this celebration of the body and the spirit of community performance and activism is something that they only know from sort of a grim anti-AIDS activism. And so that's where I'm finding, you know, so far it's been gay male, but identified as queer male scholars who've come to my archive and talk to me about that. I'm hoping there's some lesbian that gets thrilled as well and wants to do research.
Well, perhaps after they hear this interview. Now, I want to talk to you about the film that you made in 2009 called A Horse Is Not a Metaphor. It's about your experience with ovarian cancer. Well, what made you decide to turn the camera on your own very personal aspect of your life?
Well, as you know, my films, they've always been personal. Not every film, but I haven't shied away from that. But I did think with cancer I wasn't going to show it. And regardless of that, I had to take a camera to the hospital for a chemotherapy treatment because the light was so beautiful coming through the chemo drip.
Oh, my God.
So I was filming that, and my lover was filming me in the hospital bed, getting the shots through in the port, and the drip through the port. And then I had a filmmaker who came out halfway through my treatments, and she took me to the country where I went swimming nude with my bald head. And she gave me a wonderful respite. And so she had to take photos because she was interested in the scars and this lack of hair. And so I had, then about a year after, when I was in remission, I thought, I will make a film. And I even got the hospital to give me a couple $1,000s towards it.
Wow.
For those with ovarian cancer, you can apply for a special fund there from the Ladies Who Lunch. And, you know, I said, well, I want a horse. And the social worker said, I don't think they'll give you a horse. So then I said, well, how about a film about horses? And she went, and I said, okay, how about if the horse helps me get through my treatments And she goes, there you go.
So that's where the title came from.
A horse is not a metaphor, is kind of enigmatic.
Mm-hmm.
Because a horse is really a horse and not a metaphor.
Right.
But in a way, it's entering my mind when I'm in the hospital. But then it's not a metaphor when I'm in Wyoming cantering across the plains.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And it was so wonderful to find three women ranchers who gave me horses to ride.
Wow.
And they're in the credits of the film.
Huh. Did you know that you were going to survive when they did this film?
No,
or did you think this could be your epitaph?
Oh, when I was making the film. Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I didn't know I'd survive this long.
Mm.
I hoped that I would reach 74, which I am.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know that I would. I really wanted to reach 84 because that's the average lifespan of a woman today. Mm. And, you know, I only have 10 more years then. I better reconcile exactly what I want to do.
You've got work to do, Barbara.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe I have play to do.
That's possible, too. Now, you know what I want to ask you, too? You seem to want to push people into facing what many might not want to face, obviously. Now, do you think it's the business of art and film and creativity to provoke?
I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think there's all kinds of ways you can approach art, but one of the ways is to provoke. But almost always, if you want to be on the cutting edge, you're going to take risks, and you have to take the risk to fail. You have to trust what you are inclined to do, even though you might be dealing with the biggest literary figure in history. You have to treat this person the way you want to make any inroad in the form, because
mm-hmm.
otherwise we just repeat documentary film like we see on PBS,
mm-hmm.
you know, or we repeat a narrative film with a beginning, middle, and end, and even though we change the characters, they're often following a romantic structure that wasn't constructed by lesbians, you know. So let's find our new forms. Let's really look at our lives and do exactly as Tilly Olson did, as I stand here ironing, not that she was a lesbian hero, but an early feminist writer,
mm-hmm.
giving us the real time of ironing.
Uh-huh.
Or Jean Dielman, the Chantal Ackerman film, giving us the real time of woman's work.
Yeah.
Or, like Barbara Hammer, bringing in multiple shots into the time so that you're experiencing a global, spontaneous time where actually, everything is happening at once.
Mm-hmm. Are you exploring, now that you are in your mid-70s, have you been exploring aging and that aspect of culture that we seem to try to hide under facelifts and...
Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
I really think that, like we've changed our ideas about who women are in the world, we need to change our ideas about aging and go back to traditional cultures, in many cases, Native Americans, who give respect to the elder and look to the elder for guidance and include the elder. What I like the best, most that's happening now in New York, is intergenerational work,
mm-hmm.
where I go to openings of young queer artists and they come to my show or come to my studio. And I don't know if you read about Generations, but it's a film that I made with a 30-year-old dyke, Gina Carducci.
Yes, I saw that.
Yeah, so that's sort of like putting into practice what my philosophy is about intergenerational work, passing on, you know, through money, through introductions, through skill level, to the interns, to the assistants, to the young talents, so that they can have a boost up in making their name and their way in this culture that still doesn't support to its fullest extent of the law, I can now say,
mm-hmm.
the expression of queers in art, in politics, and in social justice.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. You know, I saw an interview with you where you were talking about how you might want to explore showing an old woman's body more so in your films. Are you still thinking about that?
Yeah, really strongly. Yes, I have been given a studio in Brooklyn starting September 3rd. And I'm planning on doing some work there with my body, but maybe it'll be other older bodies as well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it'll just be women. It'll start out with me, I think. I don't know if you've ever seen the photographs of John Copeland's.
I don't
know. C-O-P-L-A-N-D-S. He was a curator of photography at the Museum of Modern Art, and then he retired, and he did these amazing photographs that I have to look at again. And they showed his body in the most sagging, decrepit, realistic way. I shouldn't say decrepit because that has negative connotations where I don't want sagging to be. It's just that our skin does get loose.
Mm-hmm.
Showing what aging looks like. But the reason why his work is so outstanding is both the subject matter and the form. The way he shot through his legs, under an elbow, you know, in an armpit. It's all ways that we're not used to looking at the body.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more than just showing the aging woman body. It's how you show it.
Right, right.
And so that is foremost. Well, I don't know, foremost. It's in my mind along with some other projects.
You know, I lived in Europe for a while in the Netherlands, and I'm amazed at how afraid we are of the naked body in this country. How giggly we get, how embarrassed we get. It's amazing to me.
Yeah, it's a puritanical foundation of the country, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So I hope you make this film, and maybe you should just show bodies in all ages. What, you know, time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know what I want to ask you too, Barbara? I mean, you've gotten so many awards, and we're almost out of time. But I was wondering, is it easier for you to get funding now? Are you being celebrated more? Are you getting the credit that you should for your incredible career?
Thank you for asking that. I think I am, and I think my book, Hammer Making Movies Out of Sex and Life, also helped, and
mm-hmm.
I think the first retrospective was a breakthrough at MoMA. And, you know, you can also ask for what you want. People don't know that. When I applied for a grant, I just got the Guggenheim, which is something I've applied for many years.
Yeah.
Probably I've applied over 10 times throughout since I moved to New York in about 1982. So it's just honing your skills and learning more how to approach the asking process, which you get through experience and age. And then, of course, a couple of accolades don't help at all.
Yeah.
It's just wonderful. I want it for everyone.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, we're almost out of time. Can you give contact information if people want to go to your website? Or...
Sure. It's www.barbarahammer.com. And there's DVDs to order there. You can look at a film of my show at Jeu de Paume, which is really about my aesthetics of experimental filmmaking. And there are other resources there if you're interested.
Yeah, it's a really nice website. Well, Barbara Hammer, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you, and keep up the amazing work.
Thank you, Tish. It's been my pleasure, too. I've really enjoyed it.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.